house.
Hello, and welcome to the second episode of Interconnected Voices, a politics podcast which explores a variety of topics and platforms underrepresented and diverse voices.
You are now locked into Interconnected Voices.
Interconnected Voices. I'm Charisse, and today we will be exploring how legalising cannabis recreationally in the UK will impact the millennial generation. I had a chat with Niamh Eastwood, the Executive Director of Release, the National Centre of Expertise on Drugs and Drug Laws. They provide legal advice to individuals who have been affected by UK drug laws. Do you feel like there is a stigma attached to cannabis consumers and cannabis sellers?
I think there is a stigma. Our organisation, Beyond Services, also produces policy papers. We do research on the impact of the drug laws on communities throughout the UK.
Okay.
And in particular, when we look at the policing of drugs, and mm-hmm. I think this is a very timely conversation around things like stop and search. So we see constant calls for an increased use of stop and search to tackle knife crime, despite the evidence saying that that won't have any impact on knife crime. But in reality, when we actually look at policing, 60% of all stop and searches are actually for drugs. And our research into this looked at, well, what are people being stopped out for? And in fact, one in three of all searches, regardless of the grounds, are just for cannabis.
It's so ridiculous.
Absolutely. And we're talking about possession offences here. This is not tackling the supply market.
So because cannabis is a Class B drug, and I think you can get up to 5 years in prison. And I was reading something the other day, an article, and it was like, a young man who was on probation for possessing a small amount of cannabis was saying he thinks that police arrest you for cannabis so they can then put you on probation and then stop and search you as much as you want, which basically feeds into what you're saying. It's a constant cycle.
Absolutely. But it's only a constant cycle for certain groups. So again, the research that we did looked at who was being targeted by police, and it's young black men. So we find that black people were 9 times more likely to be stopped and searched for drugs.
What?
9 times.
Oh my God.
And that's despite government evidence saying that the black community used drugs at lower rate compared to the white community.
Aggressively you shouted, "I can smell cannabis in your car and you smell of cannabis." So I said to him, I think you're wrong because I don't even smoke cigarettes, let alone cannabis. A police lady was walking past me, so I said to her, do I smell of anything? And her reply was, let me just go and check your car. It was only when I got back to the police station when they told me exactly why I'd been pulled over. They said it was doing 50 and 40.
So, a speeding?
Yeah. So what that's got to do with being strip searched, I don't really know.
That was a clip of a young black male living in London sharing his experience of being stopped and searched for cannabis.
Then we look at cannabis possession. So this is just simple possession of cannabis for your own personal use. Black people 12 times more likely to be sentenced for that offence, despite, again, use of cannabis being lower, according to government statistics, amongst the black community compared to the white community. So I think when we talk about stigma, and I think policing reflects that stigma, that racism, if you like, in the policing. It's a way of controlling certain groups. It's an easy way to stop young black men. Police officer says, I smell cannabis. But then what we have is we have a criminal justice system that is focused on really controlling the actions of young black people in urban areas, and that becomes linked with cannabis, despite the fact we know white people are more likely to use cannabis. So stigma kind of ties into this racist narrative around it, and it's a way of demonising people and stigmatising them.
But really, when you look at it, and the fact that solicitors, lawyers, and a lot of women in high-profile positions use cannabis recreationally
absolutely.
And smoke it way more.
Well, just look at the Tory leadership.
Yeah.
Over 50%, more than 50% of the Tory leadership admitted to using cannabis. And many of them described it as a youthful indiscretion. it was a mistake. Had they known better? And I think, again, this speaks to kind of stigma and class around this issue and race around this issue. Is for them, it was like, oh, it's no big deal. They just did it when they were at university.
Yeah.
Why should they be penalised for it? Yet last year, we criminalised 19,000 people in England and Wales just for cannabis possession. 390,000 people criminalised in the last 10 years. And I tell you what, those are not the Tory leadership candidates who were trying to get to number 10.
Yeah, 100%. I don't know if you saw that there was a recent Newsweek documentary that came out, and it sent David Lammy, Norman Lamb and Jonathan Giannoli over to Canada to check out their cannabis legalisation process. And I thought that was a really interesting documentary because David Lammy was the only person, I think, before he went to Canada that had the view of, you know, it's black men that are being criminalised for it, for this, and that's the main reason I want it to be legalised in the UK. Whereas David Norman Lamb actually used the cannabis oil on the programme, which I thought was really, really good because it showed the different ways it can combat things like anxiety and sleep deprivation. And it was Jonathan Giannoli who was the most against it. But I hope that programmes like that will help to break the stigma and the fact that it's now being looked at properly by government.
Well, I think one of the things that we have to accept is that cannabis will be legalised in this country within the next 5 to 10 years. There is little doubt about that. And that's largely because there is a lot of money in this industry, a lot of money. And there is a lot of lobbying from corporate interests. And so what I was really pleased to see out of that documentary, and it was great, was David Lammy coming back and talking about the need to expunge records if we are going to regulate this market, something Canada hasn't done actually effectively. So the need to expunge records for those who have cannabis related offences. Now that's from possession through to supply, cultivation, but also provide job opportunities for people. I mean, I think we also have to realise that whether we like it or not, this illicit illegal trade provides a economic means for some communities who don't have any choices, you know. Yeah. And if we were to take away those economic opportunities for them, even if it is an illicit market at the moment, if we were to strip that away from them and put it into a legal market, the economic harm it will cause those communities will be untold. And I don't want to see a regulated market that doesn't benefit those who have been the victims, if you like, of cannabis prohibition in the UK. I want them to benefit from it, not rich white corporations.
So I'm definitely right in thinking that you are for cannabis being legalised.
Absolutely, in the right way.
In the right way. On the flip side of that, it being legalised recreationally would also mean it'd be easily accessible for consumers to access cannabis, even though it will be in low amounts. So it will be low THC, which is the magical bit that makes you feel like you're high, but also can contribute to things like anxiety. Do you think that because it will be more expensive, because there's going to be an increase in the tax bill and lower levels of strength, it could potentially lead to the illicit market and the dark web continuing to thrive?
That's a really good question. And I think if we look at countries that, and states that have already adopted this approach, so we know that Uruguay was the first country to legalize cannabis for recreational purposes back in 2013. And then we've had 11 US states and Canada, as we've mentioned already. Uruguay, for example, the cannabis there is very cheap. The president at the time, and you know, there was no public support for this, very little public support to regulate cannabis, but he really wanted to undermine the illicit trade and associated organized crime. I don't think ever organized crime is always linked to the cannabis trade, but it's part of it.
Yeah.
He wanted to do that. So he actually put it at a level that was very cheap. Problem was the quality wasn't great. And so there is, but I think what's wonderful about all of these states and countries is there is an opportunity to adapt the market to try and bring as much of it into the legal trade as possible. I think we're always going to have a little bit of an illegal trade. But if you look at cigarettes or you look at alcohol, there are illegal trades right now. But it's a very small proportion of the overall market. So it's how we manage that market. The THC argument is a very good one. So, for example, in US states, many of the US states that sell legal cannabis have very high strains of THC, very high amounts. But I think there is a conversation to be had more about CBD, which you may know about.
Yeah.
So you've talked about THC as being the kind of special part of the plant that, you know, provides the high, but is associated with things like anxiety at times. But the CBD is kind of the protective factor in the plant. And so what that does is it provides a kind of antipsychotic.
Yes. I've read about this. So it's actually been used before when people have had psychotic episodes.
Absolutely.
CBD has been used, and it's also been used as something to reduce people that suffer from high levels of anxiety and depression. So I think it's about finding that balance.
Exactly. And that's exactly what we would say. And the problem with street cannabis in the UK is the lack of CBD. So I think there's a lot, you know, this is a new market. There hasn't been a huge amount of research into the relationship between CBD and THC, except in the medical market, not the recreational market. Yeah. And so maybe the answer is much more around having high levels, reasonably high levels, 4% of CBD in the product alongside THC.
Yeah.
So that we don't have to have it at a level that's so low that people won't get the enjoyment that they're currently getting from illicit cannabis. So I think it's about making sure that market is adapted in a way that consumers are getting the product that they want, but also that we're providing harm reduction advice. And I think at the end of the day, this is now, it's a criminal market at the minute. This product is illegal. And so therefore, if someone is having problems as a result of their cannabis use, it's much harder for them to go and access services, to access medical support if they need it. And that's true for all drugs.
Yeah.
I mean, that's one of the reasons our drug policy is an absolute utter failure in this country and why people are dying from other substances.
Britain's Prohibition Misuse of Drugs Act hasn't been changed for 45 years and is truly no longer fit for purpose. There is no evidence to support Britain's ideology that if laws around the use of drugs were regulated, people would overindulge. Here's a clip of David Nutt, a substance misuse expert, giving some more insight on this topic.
So Portugal, 15 years ago, decriminalised personal possession of all drugs. They did it for economic reasons, because the prisons were filling up and they wanted a new strategy. In those 15 years, deaths from heroin in Portugal have reduced to one third of what they were before, because heroin addicts get treatment. They don't just get put in prison, or they don't get just punished. In Britain, over the same 15 years, we've increased our heroin deaths by over a third, because our policy is simply to punish rather than treat.
But I think if we recognise that moving this into a legal market, it will make it much easier for people to seek out support when they need it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there are problems with some of the existing markets that we have in Canada, Uruguay and the US states. But I think we can also learn from that. I think there's a lot to learn. And I think we can make sure that we provide a market that is not overly taxed, but does get taxed. There is going to be tax.
Yeah, 100%.
But that tax can go to good things.
100%. And I think a solution in terms of price could be that the legal cannabis should initially be priced around the illicit market price, and getting someone like a regulatory body to monitor the price and make relevant adjustments
Absolutely.
As necessary. I think that would be the only way to combat it little by little. Otherwise, we're just... the government and the regulatory bodies are just going to be on this constant chase if they're not constantly monitoring it.
Absolutely. And there are other things that we can do that are much more kind of harm reduction focused.
Yeah.
So as you are probably aware, most cannabis in this country is smoked with tobacco. Not good for our health. We know that. And that's not the case in the US. They smoke neat cannabis, which is pretty amazing.
But I also think, like, especially in places like Canada, where it's just part of everyday life, people just smoke cannabis and that's normal. I think that might be a reason why here we kind of try and mask it with tobacco.
Absolutely. But I think, you know, things like vaping.
Yes.
You know, the vapes, you know, like lots of people, you know, I see it on Twitter all the time. You know, you shouldn't regulate cannabis, that stuff stinks. Like, that's not really a reason not to regulate. But equally, too, if you're vaping, again, you can control things like smell.
Yeah.
And that's much better for a person's health. So there are things we could do within the market as well that encourages people to use cannabis products that are less damaging to health and potentially more positive to health.
Yeah, definitely. And a lot of like cannabis focused studies and documentaries suggest that there's a link between cannabis and mental health issues. So like psychosis, anxiety, schizophrenia, depression. How do you feel about that statement? Do you feel like it rings true?
I think some people do have problems with cannabis. There's a little doubt with that. I think cannabis psychosis is something that we've seen on the increase in recent years. I think it is complex.
Yes.
In terms of schizophrenia, I mean, the evidence is quite clear on this. Cannabis doesn't cause schizophrenia. But if you are someone who has a pre-existing condition, who are at risk of schizophrenia, cannabis can contribute to early onset of the condition. Mm-hmm. So there are problems around that. But again, people, you know, a lot of people who have serious mental health problems do use cannabis as a form of self-medication. And I think extracting all of the potential factors that impact their health negatively, it's very hard to just say it's cannabis.
Yeah.
And again, you know, it's just such a complex area. You know, if you're a kid who's living in an area of deprivation, doesn't have much opportunity, is sitting on video games all day, smoking weed, yeah, that's not going to be good for your health. But it's the whole environment that's potentially causing problems. Whereas often it's very easy to go, well, that's just the cannabis. And I think that's the thing with all drugs. Again, it's like these drugs do this. So, you know, heroin, you become addicted to heroin after your first hit. That's just simply not true. There are people who use it recreationally. But also, too, there are lots of people who use it problematically, but they use it in the main vast majority because they've suffered trauma.
Yeah.
And it's a form of self-medication. But suddenly it's all focused on the drug being the problem rather than going to the root causes of why that person feels the need to self-medicate or feels the need to escape with cannabis in the way that they do. So I just think these things are so much more complex, nuanced, and engage social issues in a way that we don't talk about. We tend to focus in on the substance rather than the person. And I think focusing in on the person is a much more healthy approach. And I think if we regulate, then we can, again, provide that space for people to come forward and talk about those issues in a more constructive way for them.
I think that's a really interesting way of looking at it, especially because, as you mentioned, a lot of people use cannabis to cope with trauma, and like a lot of my friends use it for anxiety, which I think is really interesting, because the reason they do that is they can't afford to see a therapist and they can't be bothered to wait for the GP referral. So they'll just rather go and spend 30 quid and get some cannabis to relax.
Yeah.
So I think you've got a huge point there. It definitely needs to be looked at as a public health issue as opposed to just cannabis causes this. Yes, there might be a link, but it's not the direct reason.
And we have to remember, most people who use cannabis don't use it on a daily basis.
Yeah.
You know, it's 90% of people will use recreationally. They'll use every so often. There's 10% of people who will use in a more dependent way.
Mm-hmm. I think a positive that it could have on mental health in terms of regulating cannabis is that it'd probably be made legal at the age of 19, similar to Canada and California. And I'm going to get into a bit of science here, so excuse if I pronounce anything wrong. The development in teenagers is influenced by the Erkabinian system, a naturally occurring process in the body and brain that helps it to develop. And that is can cause harm when substances that are powerful, like cannabis, get into the body before the age of 18. So the fact that people are going to find it more difficult to access things like cannabis and can only get it when they're 19 could have a lot of positive benefits for mental health, especially if they're taking it in the right quantities, mm-hmm. the right levels of CBD and THC. Maybe we won't see so many people affected by cannabis and that exacerbating their mental health. So that could be a huge benefit.
Absolutely. And I think age controls obviously are
a
big positive in this area. I mean, that's one of the reasons that Canada legalized. Trudeau was very clear that he wanted to protect young people. And at the minute, the laws don't protect young people.
Yeah.
So I think there's a really strong argument there for age controls, product controls, having dedicated areas where we would, you know, shops that would you know, I think of it, you know, it's interesting in this country, you know, this kind of panic that you get about legalizing drugs. And, you know, people are like, well, we'll sell it in sweet shops and supermarkets. And it's like, we're selling tobacco and alcohol in supermarkets at the minute. And so our view would be, I'd love, you know, on the like on mainland Europe, you see the tobacconist shops. So you have to actually go into the tobacconist shop and you have to get your tobacco, etc. I think we can do something similar here. It's a cannabis shop. You know, in order to enter the shop, you have to be over 18, 19, whatever the age will be. So I think in those, if we really start to have a conversation about how we manage drugs in this society, we don't do it very well currently with the legal ones. And there's ways that we could make it a much more constructive, kind of protective environment where, you know, young kids just wouldn't be coming into those shops.
Yeah. And also, you know, when you look at the shops in Canada and California, They look quite cool. Like,
they're,
I think,
very cool.
I think people might actually be pleasantly surprised at loads of edible oils, and like, there's different ways you can consume it, and it can help with things like joint pain and like, yeah, people with epilepsy. Like, there's so many benefits it can have. I think a lot of older people might be pleasantly surprised.
I think so. I think what was interesting, the research, and it's not conclusive yet, but the research from the US suggests that use amongst young people hasn't gone up.
Yeah.
So that there hasn't been an increase in high school students using cannabis as a result of the availability through the regulated market. But there hasn't been a wider kind of census of the population. Like, I could imagine my mom, she's got arthritis.
Right?
And I'm like, she would be so happy to take that rather than to take the kind of endless painkillers that she has,
yeah,
to
100%.
Take. You know, and in many ways, it might be better for her. This is the constant kind of obsession around people who are against reforming the laws. Well, we'll see an explosion in use. Well, at the minute, the research indicates we won't see it amongst young people, and that's who we want to protect. But to be frank, if there's an extra 10,000 over 60s using cannabis,
living their best life.
Absolutely.
Okay, and I also, actually, just before we move away from that, what do you think about, we touched on it briefly, but the dependence. So people that become like acute to the effects of cannabis, do you think having it readily available in shops, do you think it could make it slightly easier for them to access if they're not waiting on someone from the black market?
No, I think the black market's pretty quick at delivering these days.
It's basically like Amazon, isn't it?
Yeah,
like,
no, really. Yeah. I mean, you most people text, and at our organisation, we provide expert witness,
yeah,
statements in prosecutions against people who have been involved in the supply of cannabis. And it astounds me how many people text deals to each other. It's really, you know, it's just like evidence waiting for the police. So, you mean, call your dealer. But, you know, basically people are just calling at the minute and it arrives within a couple of hours. Nobody's having to wait. So I don't get this argument that it will be easier to access for people who are already accessing it.
Yeah.
That's just not the case.
Yeah, I do think it's really interesting that it's basically like Deliveroo.
Yeah,
like,
absolutely.
You look on the dark web, like cannabis website, and you can see reviews, they give stars, and it just comes in the Royal Mail, like,
yeah,
next day delivery.
Absolutely. But even local dealers, you know, and kind of this goes back to your point about stigma and about dealers. You know, there's always this conversation about the big bad dealer who's exploiting kids and exploiting people. And certainly there are some who are involved in the training, yeah, like that. But most people who are dealing cannabis to others are people's friends, their associates. They've known them for a long time. There's someone who lives in their neighborhood. They'll drop it off after work. So that, you know, so it's much kind of, I think it's often seen in a very black and white way.
Yeah.
There's much more nuance to this. And sometimes talking about the nuance really helps us to understand the market and understand the people involved in the market.
Yeah, no, I agree. In Oakland, California, they legalized recreational cannabis in 2018, allowing people with cannabis to open cannabis dispensaries, simultaneously launching an equity program requiring half all cannabis permits to go to applicants who are prosecuted for marijuana-related charges. How would you feel about a similar initiative being launched within the UK?
Well, that's the only thing that we would support at release. It's what we advocate for. You mean,
right.
I should say my organisation doesn't work specifically on regulation of cannabis because there's other organisations doing that. Mm-hmm. But we do work on the kind of intersection on, as I've mentioned, on race and drugs policing,
yeah,
and drug prosecutions. And so as this conversation about cannabis regulation has increased in the UK, I've become, and my team, and many in the field, actually, drug policy and harm reduction field, have become increasingly concerned about the idea of corporates occupying this space,
yeah,
at the expense of people who have been involved in the trade for a very long time, but who have also been damaged most by our drug laws, who have ended up in prison for cannabis cultivation, production, etc. And for us, there is a really important conversation to have about social equity within the UK. So you've mentioned California, and that's a really interesting model. You know, so this, at a state level, the cannabis is regulated, but it's up to kind of local jurisdictions to decide how they do that. Many have implemented social equity models, mm-hmm, and prioritized licenses for people who have previous convictions. Also, families of people who have been incarcerated. You know, I think we have to remember the intergenerational damage of the drug wars. And whilst it is overwhelmingly men, black men, African-American men in the US who have been locked up for these offences, you know, it's the women who have borne the burden of, you know, the financial and social and emotional responsibility for the family. So I feel like that intergenerational provision of licenses for communities is really important. Another interesting state is Illinois.
Yes.
And in fact, Illinois is really interesting because the other US states that have regulated cannabis did so through ballot initiatives. Mm-hmm. So ballot initiatives are where just like the voters vote for it. So it came from the kind of the constituents. Yeah. Whereas in Illinois, it was led by the legislator. So it was the local Senate and Congress who pushed through those laws. And they did it with a fundamental focus on the idea of social equity and racial justice. They believe, and I agree with this, that cannabis regulation and reform can be part of a reparations program for the African American and Hispanic community in Illinois. And I think that's where we have to start really focusing. So there they have 25% of licenses will be issued for free for people who have previous convictions, have been incarcerated, have been over-policed. They will be providing technical and financial support to them. Again, I think this is really important.
Yeah.
It's not enough to do a tokenistic, we will give you free licenses to people who haven't actually had to work in the formal economies. Mm-hmm. We have to provide support to bring them into the formal economies. So that's all happening there with a great expungement program as well. And they've said,
brilliant.
It's hard, it's complicated to do the record expungement, but we believe in this and we want to do it. And I would really love to see the UK starting to have these conversations because it really isn't part of the reform narrative at the moment. And so we really want to work with community groups who have been impacted by the drug laws across kind of urban areas, especially, I think, in England and Wales, to bring their voices into the debate. And that's a difficult thing to do. But that's where we feel that the energy needs to go at the minute.
I think it would be great. Like, it really flipped the script for the high majority, as you said, of families. It's not just about black men. It's about the people that have been impacted. The fact that they can become entrepreneurs and be empowered, and then you can bring other people in. I think that's the beauty of owning a dispensary, is that you can then bring your friends in or people you used to work illegally with, and essentially you're running a production line and training them up to open their own dispensaries. And I think there's something really quite beautiful about that, how you're changing time in prison to then coming out and making good money, doing something you clearly enjoy. But most importantly, I think something that the government needs to think about, these are the people that know how to market it.
Absolutely.
They know how to sell it and they know how to price it. So it'd be stupid for them not to use their expertise. They spent so long doing this illegally, hiding in one bed sits with putting lights over cannabis pots, for them to be able to see it come to fruition in a different light, in a way that's going to make the cannabis as well better and safer for people to smoke. I feel like it's a win-win if it's looked at in that way.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, we can learn lessons from states that regulated cannabis early on. Colorado and Washington State, for example, excluded people from the market who had criminal convictions for cannabis-related offences. And this is an anecdote that I heard, so I can't point you to a source for it. But I heard when I was in Colorado, looking at some of the dispensaries, I heard from colleagues there who work on drug policy that, in fact, some of the producers of cannabis, so not dispensaries, but the guys who are in the factories growing the hundreds of thousands of cannabis plants, they actually were hiring people who had previous convictions illegally. Yeah, because it was against their license.
Oh,
because they had the expertise.
Yeah.
They knew what they were doing.
Yeah.
And they could do a better job than some newbie who had no knowledge of the industry.
At the end of the day, like, those bigger companies are just in it for profit.
Yeah.
It's just profit driven. So it's a completely different feeling. They're not going to get any joy out of it. And there's an organization called NUG in California, which I think has a really good program that could potentially be implemented here, where they have thousands of applicants and they bring people on that have been exonerated for weed charges and just train them up. I just think that's a really nice way of doing it, but also breaks down that barrier between, like, rich middle-class white men and your average person of color who's been locked up. I think that's a really good way to do it. and potentially could help that disparity in the police system where, you know, black men don't see that representation if they're not being followed around anymore and pulled up every 5 seconds because they had a tiny amount of weed in 2002.
Yeah. And most times they don't have weed on them, actually. It's just an easy way to harass. The other thing I think is important for us to learn, though, is in Canada, for example, when they regulated cannabis, they also introduced a swathe of new criminal laws applicable to cannabis where it was operating outside the regulated market, so the illicit market.
Oh, right.
There's actually more criminal laws now in relation to cannabis than there was before regulation. Okay. And I can just imagine, and obviously they had no social equity, and I think part of that was a lack of race organisations, so racial justice organisations inserting their voice into that space. And again, that's why I think it's important that we all work in a coalition around this. But I can imagine, and we've seen this in some of the US states as well, those criminal laws end up targeting the same people who were targeted before.
Yeah.
So it provides no relief to those communities and to people of colour. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a really important thing that we actually, when we talk about a regulated model, that if there are activities outside of that model, we deal with it through a decriminalised approach, civil fines. We deal with it as breach of licences.
Yeah.
You know, there are ways that we can do this that doesn't require police officers to be stopping and searching and trying to work out if you're carrying legal weed or illegal weed. So, again, the nuance in this is important because you could see very quickly, you know, Boris Johnson, if he lasts the next few weeks, coming, you know, and you mean he is someone who is likely to support this kind of thing, to be frank.
You mean, I agree.
He's connected to various, he's just appointed someone as a special advisor who was working for an organization that advocates for regulated cannabis. So in those circumstances, you see them saying, well, we're going to regulate this, but we're going to be really tough on the people who aren't following the rules.
Right. I see what you mean.
And that's not necessarily something I think is going to benefit the communities who are currently being oppressed by our drug laws.
Speaking to Niamh gave me a great insight into the benefits that legalising cannabis in the UK could have on local communities, and also the models that could be used. Naturally, it all means more regulation for the market. And I wonder if individuals who sell cannabis as a means to provide for their family are really going to be interested in switching to the legal market when it means less freedom and a restriction on the amount of profits they could make. Are they really going to find this enticing? To give me more of an insight, I spoke to Daniel Rowe, a reformed drug dealer who does some amazing work with St Giles' Trust, an organisation who provide intensive specialist help for young people who are affected by gang-related violence. In the UK, cannabis possession and supply is criminalised. What do you think are the personal consequences of this for the individuals and their communities engaging in this activity?
So with it not being able to be sold legally at the moment, they risk criminalisation. So once they gain that, that's a criminal record that will stay with them for the rest of their life. So that will prevent certain job opportunities. It will prevent travel. They're no longer entitled to free travel. Places like America would be ruled like, America, you wouldn't be able to go to without explaining your, they ask you to explain your criminal past. So explain your life decisions up to that. And then they ask you to evidence and they give you, I think it's 5 A4 pieces of paper front and back that you have to fill out, stating and evidencing how you've changed your life and why you're now deserving of time in America to go
no
on holiday.
Way. So you basically have to write like a plea.
Well, I believe so. I know I definitely do.
And I think the worst thing about this is, you know, like 80% of cannabis sold in Britain is now grown in the UK, showing that there's lots of people selling it and they clearly feel they have no other option because they're willing to take the risk of, as you said, risk of not being able to be employed, but also the fact that they can go to jail for up to 5 years for possession and 14 years for intent to supply, which is... it's quite a big risk, I think.
It's a massive risk. That's 14 years is that's a long time of one's life. because there's all the side effects that come from being in prison. The mental ill health aspects, you're talking anxiety, depression, PTSD. Like, you're in an environment seeing unnatural things that 9 times out of 10, no one should see. Like, if you're active in this way of life, you're running the risk of, when the police kick off your door, that's embarrassment on your family. That's how my family felt when these are the things that you go through the list. It's not just as clear cut as the ones we see. It's a lot deeper than that.
And something else I thought about as well, in terms of, yes, getting your house raided is extremely embarrassing, but also, like, police, like last year, the police raided homes and seized cannabis over 94,000 times. And it's not like sometimes they have huge reasons to go and raid people's houses. Yes, they need a warrant, but a neighbour can call up and be like, I can smell cannabis, and they can literally go and destroy your home. And I thought that must be really intense for someone who is selling a large amount of cannabis. They must be in constant fear that police are going to come and raid their homes and take all their cash, their paraphernalia and their grow. But also, what happens like when you go to, if you go to prison, your house has got raided, your money's been seized and you have nothing. I'm sure that could cause issues. For example, if you owe people money or you're at the top of the pyramid and you're meant to be paying people, I'm sure when you come out, that could cause you a lot of difficulty.
People are going to want their money.
And they'll do any means to get it, basically.
Yeah, of course. When you talk about significant amounts of money in that economy, the illegal market, people, it's not like they can go to the police or call a lawyer and start legal proceedings. So if it's significant amounts of money, more time you would owe the debt and there could be significant violence used.
Why do you feel like certain areas where, you know, this is happening a lot, individuals think that this is one of their only options?
It could be they come from a broken home. It could be they come from a single parent family, an abusive background. Not only that, you have peer pressure. Sorry, just a few more came to mind. Peer pressure, glamorization, desensitization, a normalization cycle from social media, i.e. our young people now spend on average, I think it's 4 hours a day. And if we're being honest, it's probably a lot more. Now we're talking, what are they looking at? So the things they're looking at on Instagram, popular culture, what is popular culture now? What sort of things are they seeing? There's all sorts of, there's too many, it's not just one reason. There's a list of many and it differs from each individual. It would only be fair of me to talk about myself and so things in my childhood led to me being out in the community at a young age. At the young age, I was targeted, like, just when the elders drove past, yo, wagwan, yes, my lot, so on and so forth, yeah. Until I was at an age where they deemed me as useful and was like, oh, big man, shh, and started reasoning with me, so to speak. Like, I was groomed to an effect, so I went through the 4 stages of grooming. Like, however, it never felt like that. And it felt like I was taught to do this. Like, you see, you imagine the majority of my estate was involved in some sort of what I would class as antisocial behavior. No matter what it was some sort of law being broken. If you grow up seeing that and looking at the elders that have come before you, seeing as that was their only opportunity, what else are you going to do?
What do you imagine would change for cannabis sellers if cannabis is legalized recreationally in the UK? And when I ask this question, I mean, look at it in the way of, for example, if it was legalized, how Chicago have done it, which is big corporations profit from it. And they've made it really difficult for your average cannabis seller or people that have been convicted to break into the legal cannabis market. What would that be like for cannabis sellers coming into that situation?
If that is replicated over here, then the demographic of people selling cannabis now, which, as we've already attained, they're not a priority, they're going to be displaced. What do they get displaced into? Like, if these people that are already with criminal records, maybe they're selling cannabis as a way of life to provide for their family, as ill-informed as that is. But maybe with their criminal record, they don't feel like they can get a job. So what do you displace them into if the cannabis market is not inclusive? You're going to fuel them to sell, or corner them, so to speak, to sell harder drugs, thus fueling the prisons again. we want to bring crime down, we want to stop people going to prison and help rehabilitate. We have to create an inclusive market that caters to all, not just criminals, not just ex-offenders, not just those selling cannabis, but it's free and open for all to enter. You've got to look at it in its entirety. So if we're talking about someone that already has a criminal record, that is selling this already as a means of life, who is already suffering with these vulnerabilities and hasn't addressed them yet, or hasn't been able to address them yet, and then on top of that, you've now taken his main source of income in, but you're not, like, arguably he could be an expert.
100%.
The guy that's on the corner, your hand-to-hand drug dealer, as it's coined, that's a front counter expert.
Indeed.
The man that could be charged with supplying, arguably, the grower is a grower. That's a scientist. There must be a way that everybody, that it's inclusive. Like, it seems so far that all the ways that you've described are not inclusive. So maybe the UK could be the first in which makes it an inclusive market that is open to all. And there is an access route for everyone. And maybe then our young people don't suffer this displacement.
Definitely. And
because arguably the ones that haven't been caught and criminalized yet, there's now qualifications that could be run for these people. Like, this is a £1 billion industry. You can pay a fair rate that's above national wage that would be attractive to these young individuals, thus reducing reoffending. So if this is legalized in the correct way and in a just way, you could see a dramatic decrease in things like serious youth violence.
Could you expand on that a little bit more?
If those individuals are selling cannabis and now you've legalized that and opened up an inclusive market to include them, where they're paid not just a fair rate, but an attractive rate. Because like I said, we're talking about a £1 billion market, if not more, multi-£1 billion market. So if you can make the wage attractive to draw these people away from that life, they're not on the road, so to speak. They're no longer involved in that. They're now working. And instead of having these people warring on the streets, you could have them in these places working, starting their own businesses. You're taking them off the street and you're providing an opportunity. No one out there doing this. Do you think any of us wanted to make these life choices we made? No one actively wants to be out there. Like, there's things that have gone on from a really young age. There's things that have gone on within that individual's life that has led to them making those life choices. So now you're going to legalize the market. Keep it open. Invite these people in. Rather than creating the next wave of criminals, create a new wave of scientists.
Yes, I love that.
Create a new wave of doctors, a new wave of shopkeepers. Allow these people to create a future, not just for themselves, but their family. That's how it all decreases. That's how your crime goes down. That's how you get these people off the streets. If you're really going to legalize it and you have to make it an inclusive market. It should be open to all.
I agree. And Canada has really suffered by not including, as you say, scientists and expert growers in their operations to legalise it. And what it's led to is basically the illicit market thriving because, A, they don't have the expertise to produce cannabis that consumers are used to. And consumers have complained about what they're selling in dispensaries, saying there's not enough variety and it's not strong enough. And B, they don't know how to price it properly. So in the dispensary, you're paying $20 for a gram and you can go to the illicit market and get a gram for $6.37. So they're always going to be, at the moment, beaten by the illicit market. So maybe if they brought them on board, it would be a more successful operation.
The
Interconnected voices.
You basically advocate for individuals who have been previously convicted of cannabis-related offences to be supported in selling cannabis legally. And I think the model that we could use, it was a model that was done in Illinois, in Washington, D.C., who legalised cannabis this year and were the 11th state to do this, where it's allowed for drug convictions related to cannabis to be exonerated. 750,000 people have now not got criminal records and have the ability to go and open their own dispensary. They've included training programs and lowered the pricing of dispensaries for individuals who are from a lower income background. So is that the kind of thing you think would work?
Like I said, it's all going to come down to the educational process. So obviously it would be some sort of accredited or...
like an accredited certificate.
Well, yeah, you would get some form of qualification.
In addition to providing financial support, the law in Illinois also establishes marijuana job training programs at community colleges. So the courses cover a range of topics, from growing cannabis plants to establishing best business practices. It also gives people who apply and people who were previously selling cannabis assistance in the license application process. It helps to address the high cost of market entry by providing low license fees. And they also provide low interest business loans to minority entrepreneurs.
If we're looking at this, we have to look at it in its entirety once again. And we're now looking at a demographic of individuals that thrive in a hands-on environment. So are these tests going to be written tests? Is it going to be, because it should be practical. You want to know if someone can grow, give them a space, give them 12 weeks and ask them to grow. These are people that have been doing this for years.
Yeah, they know what they're doing.
So understand that your scientist can train for as much as he wants and he can be great as he wants to become. Understand his expertise and my expertise are two different things. There's over 15,000 different strands of weed right now. And if you line them all up and pulled one scientist, one member of parliament and one grower and put them all in a room, I know where I'm buying mine from if I was a smoker.
Crystal Ball, I asked a few millennials how they would respond if cannabis is legalised recreationally in the UK in the future. Crystal Ball.
Crystal Ball. You know, like what they did in, I don't know whether it was Ohio, where then they allowed people to farm it themselves and let them get into the industry. Hopefully then if they make that same system here, so that people who are already selling weed and people who already have farms can then get a way to clean their money and get legal and to have a legal dispensary and things like that, I think that would be the better option, because the idea that now the government can get a cut, therefore it is legal, it's not fair. That's the one thing I think is the worst thing. It just won't be fair to those who have been selling and have been demonised and criminalised and who've had to go to prison for it and then come out. And every time they try and get a legal job, had to declare over some sort, like declare that they were they're legally a criminal or whatever, and then can't no longer live their life in any other way. I think there has to be complete reform all round that then also has a positive impact on those who are currently selling.
A lot of people will have more freedom to explore where they buy their weed from, where, or essentially even how the weed is cured and raised and what type of strains and what it offers, etc. I think it just opens up a new sort of channel of like a new market, essentially, like a new whole, you know, the same way beer and wine, you know, goes to microbreweries now the phase of like the fad is all like microbrews and IPAs and stuff like that. I think same sort of culture will happen with weed.
The existence of a pure strain, it's kind of, it's non-existent. And then, so when you're saying things are exotic, like literally everything's exotic because everything is crossbred. So when they'll tell you, oh, this is pure this and this is pure that, the government, then they're lying. It's going to be most weed plants are spread to get like the high yield, and that's all that they're going to do. And then they're just going to slap a label on it. But really, there's actually not much difference to any of the stuff that's grown. Yeah, there are issues, there are problems. But if alcohol, there are alcohol dependency issues. Alcohol can lead to and enhance depression, like depressive episodes and things like that. Like there are downfalls to all sorts of things. I feel like there are less that are associated with weed. Deaths by cannabis are, I don't think there are any that are recorded.
Organisation like mine will write to the Prime Minister and say you should decriminalise and criminal sanctions for possession of drugs, in recognition that countries that have done this, like Portugal, Czech Republic, Spain, have better health outcomes. Our drug-related deaths are one of the highest on record since records began. We account for 1 in 3 drug-related deaths in Europe. Ours is 74 per million. Portugal's is 4 per million and Czech Republic's 4 per million. Both have decriminalised. What we get back is the Home Office doesn't intend to change its policy in this area. Drug policy is working in the UK because drug use is falling. which is not necessarily true. But that's, and our argument is a good drug policy reduces harms. That's what a good drug policy does.
In terms of like a poison or an intoxicant, alcohol is a lot worse. And yet alcohol is sold freely and advertised to children, to adults.
It definitely encouraged like being able to walk into a store and buy something that has been persecuted for so long and do it in such a open and friendly manner. Like I'll definitely do that.
Use could go up. But as I've said, so this isn't me saying what my concern would be, but what the public concern is around use increasing. The problem we have at the moment is our drug policy is measured around prevalence or around rates of drug use. So whenever, you know,
it's always been an underground culture. So I don't think essentially the top end will have a good sense of the market just yet. So I mean, I may not instantly go and purchase from the equivalent, like the Marks and Spencers of the cannabis world of in the UK, but I'm not sure what it will look like. I mean, I will probably support my local dealer, but also that's I mean, yeah, I mean, at that point there would be a certified businessman
So my concerns around the market, the crystal ball, would mainly be about corporate interests that seek to pursue profit over social inclusion within the market. So that would be my biggest concern.
Well, the UK are the leading exporters of medical marijuana. How is it that you're going to criminalise people for smoking it when you yourself are making money off of it, selling it to the wider, like the globe, the world? It doesn't make sense.
So I have a bit of a green thumb, like I like gardening and stuff like that. And I think eventually, I think I'd love to like live on a sort of patch of land where I can rear the land and stuff like that. So I think this is definitely something that I'd like to do. And if it was within scope, if legalization meant that I could sort of set up a dispensary, it's only now that the governments around the world are seeing the potential of legalized cannabis that are now paying attention, rather than paying attention to the actual consumers who just wanted to, you know, smoke a joint in peace and not be persecuted for it. So now it's sort of like, do the government have our best interests at heart if their incentives are money and not necessarily, yeah, decriminalizing it. So I think I'd rather decriminalize cannabis first, and then maybe set up a system to have it as part of the legal system, or if there was a way to generate money and sort of a new industry, I guess. That's what I'd definitely support.
And I don't think it will change. Even if things are legalised, they will still stop black people. They will still search black people. They'll still tell black people that they've got over the amount. That's the long and short of it. That's a reform that would have to come in other ways.
We have reached the end of episode 2. Thank you so much to my incredible guests to contribute into this episode. If you want to find out more about the amazing charities that Neve and Daniel work for, please click the links below in the Mitzcal description box. Please follow at Interconnected Voices on Instagram to get an insight into future shows, and at Transmission Roundhouse to find out what's going on at the station. Thanks so much for listening to episode 2. I've been Charisse on Interconnected Voices.
Roundhouse.